Welcome to For the Love of Conversation, the podcast that grew out of 3 Minute Storyteller, where we believe conversations connect us and social change begins with the stories we tell. At 3 Minute Storyteller, we share digital stories, video snippets of intimate, messy, expansive conversations with a wildly eclectic bunch of artists, scientists, leaders of all stripes, all who are legendary change agents. Some you may know, and hopefully many you don't. This podcast is the opportunity to bring you into the full conversation. I'm Shannon Mannon, along with my husband Mike and our VW bus Scarlett, who we've outfitted into an awesome mobile storytelling unit. We invite you into the full conversation with us. We're so glad you're along for the ride. David and Nick Sheff are the real-life father and son duo on whom the movie Beautiful Boy with Steve Carell was based. Now these two are on a mission to make sure other families don't have to face the brutal hardship of addiction like they did. But their advice for preventing and coping with addiction might surprise you, and it's relevant to anybody seeking their own beautiful and purposeful and meaningful life. And here's a hint. It has to do with our emotions and giving ourselves permission to feel the hard stuff as well as the good stuff. My conversation with these two left such a deep impression on me. Their love is so strong that I think you might feel it too, straight through the airwaves. So here's my conversation with New York Times bestselling authors David and Nick Sheff. Thanks so much for listening. So I wanted to start grounding us a little bit in your childhood, Nick. If you could start maybe first by sharing a little bit about you've talked about your relationship with your dad being something very intimate and very kind of special and different than I think a lot of father-son dynamics. Can you just describe what that was like at the youngest age of your memory?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I was born in Berkeley and I grew up in San Francisco. And when I was, I guess I was four or something, my parents got divorced and my mom moved to LA, and so, you know, my dad really was like my primary caretaker, and you know, I just remember feeling so close to him, and like we had just this incredible relationship and it was really fun. I remember you know, he didn't do a lot of cooking, so we would like go out to eat all the time and go walk around the city. And
we would go to restaurants and they would know Nick. And we went to a Japanese restaurant a lot and he only would eat orange teriyaki or whatever. Is that what it was? And so we would always just get carrots and sweet potatoes. Not the teriyaki.
The tempura. Yeah.
Only carrots and sweet potatoes.
Yeah,
sorry.
So it was fun. No, it was fun. And and then even, you know, when, I mean, you didn't ask about this, but then, you know, when my dad met my stepmom, you know, I loved her and she was such an incredible mom to me. And then I had, you know, they had my little brother and sister. You know, we were just this very close family and we, you know, read stories together at night and, you know, went on walks and went surfing. And it was pretty, you know, I feel really lucky.
And David, can you talk about Nick and your, you know, what he was like as a boy?
Well, you know, I'm his dad, so what am I gonna say?
Amazing.
But he's amazing. he is amazing and was amazing then. And he, we just had so much fun. And I was so proud of him. We just, you know, he had, there was just a lot of laughing. I mean, there was a hard part I think for him that, you know, when his mom got and I got divorced. I mean, that was really a stressful thing. That was a sort of a through line through his childhood because she lived in LA and I lived in San Francisco, and Nick had to sort of go back and forth. He went to see her for holidays and parts of summer, and I know that was a lot of stress and it was very, very difficult. But otherwise, you know, sort of even in spite of that, it felt like, you know, that he was doing great. He, you know, he had this amazing sense of humor from the beginning and really, really artistic and creative, and he had his own fashion sense, and he, you know, very, very unique and good friends. And I don't know, we just spent a lot of time doing all the stuff that, you know, that you do. I mean, I guess maybe especially when we moved out to West Marin, which is where we've lived for a long time, then he became a surfer and we surfed together and we traveled all around Northern California searching for the perfect wave. taking hikes on beaches and things like that. And when he was in middle school, he became best friends with this girl whose name is Jet. And Karen and I, my wife and I, we fell in love with her, and we used to hang out with them all the time. And what I didn't know is that Nick had a complete crush on her the whole time.
And you didn't know that? I'm surprised.
Well, I just knew. I guess I kind of knew. But I knew that, they really adored each other. But then they sort of went off to in different directions in high school. And I'm jumping way forward in the story. But they re-met about 7 or 8 years ago and are married now.
Yeah, that's true.
I read that you had, you knew her.
Yeah.
A new part of it. Well, her name's Jet. Like, she has to be awesome.
Yeah, she is. Cool. She is awesome. She is. It's a cool name. It's true.
Yeah.
So then you both, you know, obviously fast forward through a really horrific time in your lives, but you wrote these memoirs that kind of came out simultaneously in Tweak and Beautiful Boy, and obviously Beautiful Boy now, you know, became a really incredible movie, and congratulations on that whole process. It's incredible. And I just want to talk about your respective sides in terms of reading each other's memoirs, reading each other's incredibly vulnerable, incredibly painful work, and how that was a sense of a little bit of a wake-up call in terms of seeing a common experience through a different lens of father and son and son and father. Mm. So can you talk a little bit about what it was like when you were able to use, I mean, it's a gift, because a lot of people that
it
go
really
through
was a gift,
addiction
yeah.
and this painful process aren't incredible writers like you guys right. are, and that's just a really unique lens to digest and process this painful emotional trauma. Mm. David, do you want to start and talk about what it was like for you to read next week?
Well, it was a gift, because when you're outside and you're watching someone, when I was watching my son, you know, sort of go through this hell, and our family is going through hell, it's just confusing, you know, it's baffling. I mean, we talk more about addiction now, drug use now, and so we have a little bit more understanding, and we still don't talk about it enough, but we really didn't know about it then, and so it was just this baffling thing that my son, who was, as I was just describing, you know, this sort of like amazing, lovely person, and completely, you know, kind and gentle, and an amazing big brother to his little brother and sister, in a way that most kids who are 11 years older, you know, aren't sort of to the next, kids from the second marriage. And he sort of just transformed when he started to use drugs. And so from my perspective, it was just really, really confusing. It's like, what happened to him? And we spent, you know, 10 years, and there was a, you know, everything got worse and worse and worse, and Nick would disappear, and he did things that were unbelievable that he would do. He broke into our home and our friend's home once, and he would disappear, and, you know, we were completely freaked out. And so when I finally read his book, everything shifted for me. First of all, you know, there was so much focus up until then on trying to help him. And trying to also survive it myself, and to try to protect, you know, Karen, my wife, and Daisy and Jasper, that there was, I guess it was not possible for me to really get inside his head and to understand what he was going through and what he was feeling, and also to understand how bad things were, because as much as I knew things had gotten terrible, I didn't know how bad it had gotten. But it was sort of a revelation to read his book. It opened my eyes, because I realized that, you know, we have this idea of what people are like, you know, what people who are using drugs are doing. They're doing it because, you know, they're selfish, they want to be high, they want to have fun, they don't care about anybody else. And when I read Nick's book, I realized he wasn't having fun. He was in pain from, you know, page one till the end, and he was suffering, and he was trying so hard to feel better. And, you know, then addiction kicked in, and of course when he was addicted, he was out of his mind, because that's what addiction is. And so it was heartbreaking to read it. It was just so sad to imagine my son in those, you know, terrible, terrible, scary situations. And it also, it's not that my heart wasn't already open. I mean, obviously I adored him and was worried, and, you know, and that never changed. But I guess it opened my heart in a little bit of a different way. I just felt so bad. That's all it was about. It was like, oh my God, my poor, you know, son had to go through that.
Thanks, Dad.
it's true.
Yeah, I mean, it was similar, I guess, for me in the sense that, I mean, different, but I guess when I was using and stuff, I always thought that, I knew that my actions were affecting my family, but I guess I also had this sort of, I don't know, maybe I was in denial, but I thought that, you know, my dad would be able to, I don't know, kind of move on and, like, just focus on, you know, his other family with my brother and sister and my stepmom and just kind of, you know, let me go. And I felt like if I wanted to, you know, kill myself with drugs and alcohol that, you know, it was sort of, I was hurting me. And reading Beautiful Boy, when I finally read it, you know, I realized just how untrue that was and how there was never a moment when I was out there that my dad and my whole family wasn't just completely just consumed with worry for me. And, you know, I was, you know, I guess I just was, I know it really moved me when I realized that that they had spent so much time and you know, they just worried so much about me. And my dad had done so much research to try to kind of understand what had been going on with me. And that was really moving to me. And it did shift things for me, I have to say. And it made me want to fight even harder to try to figure out how to you know, get better from this thing.
You know, the love that you guys had for each other, you can feel it right now in this moment. You know, that it hits so cliche, but it's a testament to how it truly got you through and both of you through.
Yeah, it's not a cliche. Maybe it sounds like one, but it's not. It's sort of everything. And I guess any parent understands what that means, what it's like. And that's why, you know, this, I mean, you never, obviously, when a child becomes ill, it's devastating for parents. And the problem is even, it's not, I can't say it's worse, because it's, you know, I haven't had to face a child having another life-threatening disease. But addiction has a very specific character, which is it's the only disease, I mean, maybe schizophrenia, a few other things that change behavior as well. And so it's not just that you watch someone who's ill and it doesn't appear that they're ill. You know, it's hard to imagine how an illness could make a person, you know, Nick would go off and disappear for days and he'd go find drugs. And how is that an illness? And, you know, eventually I understood that that's what a brain disease is. It means that the very sort of, you know, the organ that is supposed to be able to allow us to make good decisions and to make decisions at all is sort of gone haywire. But as bad as it got, and you know, that's why, it's why also that it does get that bad is because we just love them so much. Mm-hmm. And I think that one of the things that Nick said, actually, just we were just talking about it the other day, is somebody asked him, you know, it's sort of like, did you know at the worst, like when Nick was really mad at me and he wasn't speaking to me for a while, or we weren't talking, if he knew somehow that you know, I still loved him. And he says that, you know, that he did. I mean, underneath all that, it's just there.
Yeah, I felt that way for sure. And I guess like what my dad was saying, I didn't want to be doing what I was doing. I mean, it was almost like I was, you know, hijacked by the drugs in some way, where I would see myself, you know, doing this behavior that was just totally unconscionable, and I was, you know, acting in these, you know, belligerent ways and you know, doing all these things, yeah, that my dad was saying. And I saw myself doing it, and I didn't want to be doing it, and I felt all this guilt and shame about it, but I couldn't stop. And that really is, you know, the most sort of one of the most terrifying things about this disease is, you know, a sick brain can't fix a sick brain. And, you know, I was, you know, I really was being sort of, like almost like it was like being possessed or something, like having this demon in my body that was making me do things. But the person that I had been or am, you know, was still there too. And so I was like in the sunken place or something. And it was terrible. I mean, and I'm so grateful, you know, that my family didn't give up on me, because I know, you know, I'm sure that there were, I mean, I know that there were times when it felt like it was never going to get better, and it felt that way to me. And so the fact that, you know, they never stopped loving me and stopped being there for me is, you know, I owe everything to that.
I want to talk about, you know, it's a great segue, because you write, you know, Tweak is such an unusual drug memoir, which it's not really, but it really talks about, it gets inside of the suffering of a teen, a young person, and they're, you know, and they're through their 20s, and it's both of you write with this kind of breathtaking compassion around this problem of mental illness and addiction from so many sides of it. And I really want to talk about the shame and the guilt that are layered upon the disease, because it's just what other condition has that attached to it. So Nick, I wanted to start with just, you know, it seems like you were able to communicate and shout out from like the adolescent mind so beautifully, like this is, you know, the grip that it had you in, and what forced you or what drove you to, you know, to take drugs in the first place, and why you stayed that way. And now you've been out kind of with young people and hearing from them, and I know it's really touched a nerve. Can you talk about just being inside that despair and how being there has allowed you to touch and reach other folks who are also there?
Oh, well, thank you for saying that. I just remember, when I first smoked pot when I was like 11, 11, it gave me this really real sense of relief, because up until that time, you know, I just remember feeling so sort of uncomfortable in my own skin and insecure, and like I would look around at all the people around me and it seemed like they all knew exactly what they were doing and they seemed so confident, and I just didn't feel that way at all, and I felt so anxious. And smoking pot, you know, it made me feel better at first. It was like it numbed me out from those feelings, and it felt like almost like medicine for me or something at first. And it was the same, you know, with alcohol. I felt like once I started drinking and using, it was like I could suddenly go to parties and talk to girls and, you know, do all these things that I've been too scared to do, you know, without those substances. And, you know, I think that's something that we really want to talk about with our new book, actually, because, you know, the big question that we get almost more than anything else is about prevention and, you know, how do we help young people not go down this path of drug abuse? And even if it's someone that's not going to get to the point that I was at, where, you know, I was using IV drugs and, you know, I was homeless, and you know, but even just for someone who is finding that they're using pot and alcohol as a way of not having to, you know, cope with or not having to deal with sort of difficult emotions, and it feels like they need to get high in order to go to a party or even just have relationships at all. You know, it really feels like the more that we can help young people sort of find other ways to sort of cope with those feelings and teach them the skills that they need to sort of deal with difficult emotions and even good emotions, and learn to sort of sit with those feelings and work through them, I think the more that we're going to be setting people up for, you know, such an easier time in life and just so much more, you know, success, not externally even, but just internally. And, you know, it's really a serious thing. I think kids today, even more than when I was growing up, are under such a tremendous amount of stress. And, you know, the social media stuff and climate change and, you know, the economy. I mean, I think kids are aware of all this stuff, and it can feel like we're living in a really hard time. And you know, I talk to young people all the time that seem very hopeless about the future. So really helping young people to develop these skills in a different way, and to learn to be comfortable in their own skin and to love themselves, it's kind of the most important work that anyone I think could be doing right now is giving this to a generation that feels like it really needs it. For me, the thing that I'm so grateful for more than anything is just, you know, being able to wake up in the morning and to feel, you know, good about myself and like to, you know, like who I am and to feel joy with, I mean, in just sort of the little things of life, like going for a walk with my dogs, or, you know, going out to dinner, or going to a movie. And to be able to experience that, you know, when I thought there was never a chance that I would ever feel anything like that, you know, is such a huge gift. And, it wouldn't have been possible without the, just so many people that really have devoted their lives to helping people with substance abuse issues and mental health issues. And that's the cool thing that we found. I mean, my dad could talk about this more, but there's, you know, a lot of problems in the treatment system, in treatment sort of centers in this country, and, there's problems with healthcare and all this stuff. But at the same time, there are these incredible people working in all communities to help people. And, there's amazing, county-run programs, there's scholarship programs for people who are struggling. There's 12-step meetings, which are free. And, you know, I've met people in the rooms of the 12-step rooms that, you know, are so generous and are willing to give so much of themselves to help people who are new in sobriety. And, you know, they're not getting anything out of that other than just, I mean, it's just completely altruistic. And it's so inspiring to see that. So, I of course owe my life to that. And I think it's really important to sort of give those people their due.
You, after going through this, this hell, living hell with your almost losing your son, your family, and you touched on this, Nick, was able to experience a level of joy that's deeper and richer, mm-hmm. and a level of meaning. Mm-hmm. And I think like the Dalai Lama talks about how, you know, joy and suffering are two sides of the same coin. Mm-hmm. You know, the deeper you suffer, the more mm-hmm. open your I don't know, your ability to access joy. How can you talk about that?
I think it's true. I think it's true what Nick just said about that young people, anybody who's struggling, but the reason that it's so concerning that so many young people use drugs, it's not just about getting high, but it really is about escaping the tough stuff, you know, whether they're suffering because they're feeling lonely or isolated, or they're struggling in school, or they have problems with their families, or they've suffered loss, or anything. And, you know, drugs are really effective as a way of anesthetizing, you know, themselves, ourselves. But the problem with that, of course, is that you don't learn to feel at all. And if you don't learn to feel the bad stuff, you can't feel the good stuff. And that's something that I did learn that throughout this whole process, because I didn't want to feel, because it hurts. It's really hard. And but when you kind of go through the door, and you sort of open up to that, and eventually I had to. It was almost not a choice. I either was going to go, you know, insane or die or something. I mean, the doctors always told me it wasn't related, but in the middle of this whole thing, I had a brain hemorrhage. You know, maybe that's at least a metaphor for shutting down and holding it all inside, that the opposite happened ultimately. And there's this fear that if we feel pain, it's going to kill us. But the irony, of course, is that it actually frees us in a big way, because it releases that we're holding inside. The idea of suffering, you know, it's a cliche that says that, you know, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And it's exactly right. And so, you know, we went through this experience that could have killed us as a family. It certainly could have killed Nick. But because we survived it, we are stronger, I think, as people, as individuals, and I think we're a stronger family. I think there's not a second that we take one another for granted. We enjoy the joyful moments all the time, and they sort of, you know, they're, I mean, talk about lucky and blessed, and all of a sudden, for a while, our son, Jasper, Nick's older brother, a younger brother, and then Daisy, his little sister, they were all over in different cities. Daisy was home, and Jasper was in New York, and Nick was in L.A. Then Daisy went to college in Los Angeles, so she and Nick were there, and then finally Jasper graduated from college, and he moved there. And so, like, the three of them were living in the same city, and they would go to the movies, and they would go out to dinner, and they were, they'd go surfing together. Daisy and Nick are, like, surf partners, and, what is better for a parent than to be able to see their kids, not only, you know, obviously survive and be healthy, that's the most important thing, but to see that they're friends and to see that they like each other. I mean, it's sort of remarkable, especially if you look at where we were, you know, 10 or I don't know how many years ago now, 10, 12 years ago.
And you found when you wrote with Beautiful Boy 2 that it was like screaming out, again, it came out at a time before, like you said, we're still bad at talking about this stuff, and we were even worse at back then. What was it like to be so vulnerable, and how did that give voice, what kind of the response to that seemed very powerful?
From a
family side.
Yeah, it was really scary. But I guess, you know, I guess things were sort of just chaotic there, and this is, and I've been writing throughout the whole experience, not to publish anything, but just to try to get through the night sometimes and just get my thoughts on paper just to get them out of my head, talking about that. And then when Nick was doing better, you know, the other thing is I am a journalist, and so I write, and that's not, I mean, it is part of the way that I've always processed whatever I've been dealing with in my life, and the tough stuff, of course, is the thing that takes over and becomes, you know, paramount. And so it was natural to write about it. The part that wasn't given was publishing it. But there were a couple reasons that it felt like a really valuable thing to do. And one of them was that at the time that Nick became addicted, the main drug he became addicted to was crystal methamphetamine. And, you know, people weren't talking about it. We didn't really know about it in the country. I mean, now everybody does. But so I wanted to alert people about this drug that was incredibly dangerous and toxic and killing kids. And then the other reason was just because we are part of this denial culture that feels like, you know, addiction is about other families, it's about other people, it's about people that don't look like us, whatever. And we learned that, you know, addiction can hit any family, any person, and so it felt important to say that too. But still, it was scary. You know, I felt like we were going to be exposing ourselves to judgment, scrutiny, and, you know, and I was warned by some people not to publish it for that reason. But when the books came out, you know, Nick's book, Tweak, and my book, Beautiful Boy, by sort of just weird, it wasn't planned, but they both were finished and ready to publish at the same time. When they came out, you know, there wasn't one person who criticized us. It was the opposite. It was that people said, you know, thank you that someone's talking about this, and thanks for telling our story. And so what we learned, of course, is this lesson that, you know, in some ways maybe it should be obvious, but it isn't, which is, you know, everybody's suffering, and everybody pretends they're not. But when we're open, you know, it's just this huge relief. People will realize they're not alone. You know, we're all in this together. Life is hard.
One of the things that your book, your writing taught me is this, you know, the fallacy of waiting for your, I feel like there should be, like, you probably have written this article, like, 10 myths, what we do wrong with all of this. This fallacy of letting our, someone who's suffering, you know, hit bottom.
Yeah.
And I want to, like, kind of tease that out with this concept of also letting go. It seems like there was a level of, you had to accept the level of powerlessness you had over Nick's situation and the substance abuse, but then again, you also didn't want to wait for him to hit bottom. Can you tease that out or talk about how you held both of those kind of like tensions?
Yeah. Well, that's like, you know, that's one of the things about going through this is that there are not any easy answers, and it would be really nice if there were. And when you fall into this, the thing that family members hear, whether it's, you know, parents like me or brothers and sisters and children of addicts and alcoholics or whatever the relationship, is that you have to step back, you have to let go, you have to let them hit bottom, you have to practice tough love. And so, because we don't know any better, we listen. And that was always haunting me, and I couldn't, and I didn't understand it until finally I just was, I guess, so broken because I felt like I'd tried everything else and nothing had worked. And so I kind of was doing what they told me, and I hung up the phone once when Nick called, and I was, you know, devastated. We were just lucky that Nick ended up getting himself in treatment. And I hear all the time from people who did the exact same thing for the exact same reasons, because it was sort of hammered into them that that's what you're supposed to do and that's the way you deal with addiction. But then they did shut the door or hang up the phone or whatever it was, and then their child went out and died. And, you know, I just feel like that is... it's so destructive, it's evil. I mean, for people to tell people who are already vulnerable, parents, kids, again, whoever it is, that you have to step back and shut the door and let go of somebody who is dying, when every instinct that we have is, if it's someone you love, is to embrace them and do everything you can to help them. I mean, I think that is, I think it's really, not only is it cruel, but it also is destructive because it doesn't help anybody. But that doesn't take into consideration the fact that this is really tricky. And ultimately, as I say in the book at one point, you know, it is a heartbreaking revelation for parents to realize that in the end, we can't decide whether our children are going to live or die. And it's true about all of our kids. And it's just against everything that, you know, drives us as parents. I mean, we want to protect them. We want to help them. You know, we don't want them to suffer anything. You know, we don't want them to suffer being teased, never mind, you know, when they're little, or you know, getting excluded from their, I mean, anything. It's just, you know, but, you know, at a certain point, especially, we have to let go. But the message is different. The message is not, the answer to that message is that, this became sort of my mantra. Addiction is a disease. My child has a disease. You don't let go of somebody who's a disease, who has a disease. All you want to do is treat them with compassion and love, and then try to get them treatment by, you know, in the best way that you can, the best treatment that's available. And that's not enabling people. That's not, you know, that's not forgetting the fact that you can't ultimately make the decision for them. But you just would, I would just try and try and try and try until it was no longer an option.
You know, we haven't yet spoken about painting a new picture of support in a vision of a perfect world. I mean, I know you've written extensively on and researched extensively, David, on how we could do better. Can you help with the vision? I'm a little tired of in this political moment of like everyone being, you know, it's so easy to be against it, you know. But what is like the vision of what we want? What's the compelling goodness that we hope for our country, our world, in terms of how we handle substance abuse?
I think the big shift comes when we understand the people who are addicted. They become addicted. It's not a choice. Nobody wants to be addicted. We've always vilified people who are addicted. We punish them. Not only is it wrong in sort of moral ways, it also is destructive, because people who are addicted already feel terrible about themselves. They're in pain physically and emotionally, and the shame is enormous. And so as we shift to understand that addiction is a disease and it's a brain disease, we shift, I think, hopefully in our communities and then eventually in our country and hopefully even, you know, bigger than that, everywhere, to understand that people who are addicted are ill. And so we have to shift the way that we think about them and treat them. And, you know, the positive thing is I think that's going to happen. I think that because of our recognition of addiction as an illness, there are people who are devoting their lives to studying addiction. There's a lot of research going on. Unfortunately, it's really hard to access good treatment now still. But at least we kind of know more about addiction. And so if people do get in the hands of good addiction doctors, they can be treated. You know, we didn't even know that a short time ago. So a lot of it's about shifting this paradigm so that we treat this as a health problem instead of as a problem of morals and ethics.
And criminology.
And criminology,
No, I mean, I agree with that completely. I think for me, just even on a personal level, once I really accepted this idea, I mean, this truth that addiction is a disease, it shifted things for me, and I was able to really start to do, you know, what people suggested for me to do and take their advice. And I started working with a doctor who, you know, is an addiction specialist, and that's been amazing. And you know, I think a lot of people, when they, like my dad was saying, when you hear this idea that addiction is a disease, it doesn't make sense. And I even thought it was like something that they were telling us in rehab so that we would like be easier on ourselves, or it was like a cop out or something. But I really, through trial and error, I tried all these different combinations, and I really have discovered that, you know, whatever my brain chemistry is, when I put a mind-altering substance into my body, this phenomenon of craving starts and this obsession starts, and it is almost impossible for me to stop. And a normal person doesn't have that relationship with drugs and alcohol. So it really is real, and you know, I think just the more we can sort of raise awareness of that fact, I think the more things will start to change, and you know, we'll be able to also start to, I think, you know, hopefully see a decrease in the amount of deaths that we've been seeing recently. I know I've had a number of friends in the last year that have died of overdoses, and it's, I don't know if we talked about this, but the numbers are over 200 people a day are dying from overdoses. So it really is a crisis, and it feels like, you know, it's really important to spread this word right now.
Thank you so much for listening to this conversation with David and Nick Sheff. If you want to learn more about David and Nick and all of their many projects, please follow them. You can find them at Nick_Sheff and at David_Sheff. To stay updated on their projects and their research and their advocacy and education and their uncovering. Also, please check out their latest book, which is called High, Everything You Want to Know About Drugs, Alcohol, and Addiction. Plus, David's got a new fund called the Beautiful Boy Fund, which is raising money and support to help addiction medicine. And so the horrible disease of addiction doesn't keep taking the lives of our loved ones. Also, links to everything that I've said here can be found on our website, 3ms.co. That's the number 3, the letters ms.co. While you're there, please subscribe to our mailing list so you never miss a story from us. Also, I hope you're following us on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook. And again, you can find us at 3 Minute Storyteller. Thanks so much again for listening, and we're so glad you're along for the ride.